My name is Alan Bailey. I've been working with OAC Ministries throughout my ministry, which means something like 33 years ago that I got started. And I'm engaged in a range of Bible teaching and evangelism. This, of course, has taken me away from home a lot in the past 33 years. I was married a year after joining the work, which means that when my wife and I were married, we were both aware of what lay ahead of us in principle. I dare say we didn't know too much about the detail. Who knows about tomorrow? But we surely did realise that it wasn't going to be a 9-to-5 situation. We realised that we weren't going to have weekends just to do what we wanted to do together. We realised there were going to be certain strains when children came along and so on. So we went into it open-eyed, but as I say, probably knowing very, very little about the detail that was coming up, because the future is just so closed to us in so many, many ways. But I look back now, and I do give thanks to God for what has happened in the following 32-plus years since we were married. I'm grateful for a happy marriage. I have said on some occasions in various seminars that I run that I'm not sure just how it could have been happier as far as our marriage is concerned. It's just been great. We've had three children. God has graciously given us two daughters and a son. Those two daughters are now one just a bit over 30 and just the other just a bit under 30 years of age. They're walking with God. In fact, both of them are on the mission field. One is in Europe, one is in Asia at this particular time. Our son, who's the youngest in the family, he's 26 years of age, and he's in Bible college and hopes next year to be in Asia, because his heart is in Asia. And we thank God that he hasn't given us any in-laws or grandchildren at this point of time, though we've done a lot of praying that he would. We're not so much concerned about what we get, but we are really concerned that our children find real fulfilment in their lives and fulfilment in the Lord Jesus. But it hasn't been God's purpose at this point to give them partners, but he has given them a calling, and each one has a heart for evangelising the world. Some of you may have this experience to look forward to go down to the airport and see them off. Don't know how many times we've seen them off to some place or another, but it's not easy. It's one of those things that, you know, you need the grace of God for, and yet I wouldn't see them anywhere else but where God wants them to be. And if the three of them are at the ends of the earth from this time forward and we don't see a whole lot of them, I'd much rather them be there than living up the street just to please Mum and Dad. It's never been on my heart to want them there. Well, we're going to look at the evangelist and his family now, and I'd ask that you not read ahead, but we go through this together, and you make some notes perhaps on the sides or around the place, and ask questions when we come to the point that we're going to ask questions. You will have plenty of time to do that, I promise you. In the past two decades, much has been said about the obligations, challenges, demands and rewards of family life. Christian awareness of responsibility in this whole area is heightened by a love for God and a desire to please Him. For those in full-time Christian ministry, an array of tensions can easily be set up. Many of us have experienced heart-rending struggles in raising a family, or at least we know many in our circle of acquaintance who have. It's hardly necessary to say that many Christian marriages are under great pressure today, some failing altogether. I think if we were to ask around the circle here this afternoon, you would probably all know someone who's a Christian, whose marriage is either in trouble or has actually struck the rocks and has broken up. We don't have to look very far for it today. And we're suggesting that an alarming number of Christian parents have rebellious children who are not following the Lord. In my ministry, I'm hearing about this all the time. Parents who are heartbroken because their offspring are not going on for God. And this is a great grief to them. The lifestyle of an evangelist, however, is unique. We're zeroing in on this matter of the evangelist's family life. Yes, there are other callings that take people away from home for long periods, and that swallow up weekends, and that cause very late nights and long telephone conversations, hours spent in a study, and the entertaining of visitors. You can think of some callings that would involve all of that. But the evangelist has a dimension which makes his calling different. He is at the cutting edge of a spiritual battle. He is opposed keenly by spiritual forces. His personal and family life are his soft and vulnerable underbelly. Many ministries have been halted or drastically altered through unrest or trauma in the family. And you can see the implication there that if the evil one wants to stop the work of God that's going on through an evangelist, or perhaps an evangelist and his wife, he very often will attack the family, the most vulnerable part, because it does seem to succeed so often in getting people out of the service of the Lord. Who would dare suggest that he has all the answers to the pressing questions that are raised by those desiring to maintain a happy marriage and raise a godly family in our times? Well, I'm certainly not one who says he's got all the answers. I think today all we're going to do is suggest some guidelines. And in this paper, the key word is the word together, a word chosen as the antithesis of the apartness of many modern families. I think if I were to pick a word that characterises modern families, I would say apartness is it. And I'm not simply saying that, they've broken up and gone in different directions, or the kids have flown the coop and they've left home and so on. I'm not thinking of that geographical or physical apartness. I'm thinking of the fact that we live what some of us term modular lives. You know, especially as the kids grow up and they've got high school responsibilities and they've got sporting responsibilities and social contacts and so on. Each person in the family seems to have his or her own circuit, his or her own timetable. Now, I know this has got to happen to a degree, but you know what I mean, don't you? When father leaves the house at a certain time and jumps in the car, mother leaves at another time, son leaves at another time, daughter leaves at another time, they go in multi-directions. Then, of course, later in the day, they're coming home, some of them only briefly, some of them not even coming home until 10 or 11 o'clock at night because they've been out to work and then to a dinner and then to something else, and so it goes on. And they begin to, you know, just pass each other like ships in the night, you know. They see each other in the passage briefly, long enough to say, there's something in the microwave for you, you know, switch it on and help yourself. Isn't this lifestyle today? This is modern living, isn't it? And what we're saying is that each person is a module. Each person has his or her own timetable to keep. And we don't often get together and look at each other. We don't have time to just look at each other's face or look at each other's eyes. Sometimes it's flopped down into a chair, but we're not looking at each other, we're both looking at the TV. And this is the way so many live. So I'm suggesting that the word together is perhaps some sort of an antidote to the problems that we have today, but particularly is this the case when we've got at least one member of the family whose calling takes him away from home. Now, you're going to find me using that masculine pronoun so very often in this talk, because it would seem to me that the evangelist who's the full-time platform type evangelist, or maybe someone who's training others in evangelism or in some way is involved full-time in evangelism, at least in my experience around Australia, is a man. Now, you may want to suggest that there are heaps of others. I'm just saying, well, I haven't met them at this point, and I don't want to by any means say that women do not have a place in evangelism. I'm not going to say that for one moment, nor even suggest that. I am going to say that when it comes to the kind of person I've got in mind here, the itinerant professional, the person who's full-time, who's leaving home, it's usually Dad. It's not usually Dad who's left behind. I know there are many speakers and so on who go here and there, ladies who speak at the women's conventions and so on, and my wife's very much involved in all that sort of work. But if there are principles, of course, that you see through here that apply to both of us, then let's just pick them up and get what is useful out of it. I certainly don't want to get into any arguments about women's ministry. Please just spare us that on this occasion. First heading, being together. Nothing can substitute for the joy of immediate close fellowship between partners and family members. We must plan to have it. This allotted time needs to have quantity about it as well as quality. We so often hear of folks saying, well, I have quality time, and sometimes it's an apology for the fact that they're not really spending very much time at all. I rather think that it's good for us to avoid that term quality time and suggest that all of the time should be quality. Why should we be aiming at something that's, you know, got a higher degree of quality than on another occasion? Smacks to me of, you know, perhaps a double standard there. So the pace of life has got to be measured. In other words, if we don't learn how to say no, if we don't learn how to set our program out in such a way that it can be handled, then we'll find ourselves engulfed in so many things that we won't have quantity time left to give to our family. Married couples involved in itinerant evangelism must begin with an understanding about their chosen lifestyle, gained through frank discussion and prayer. It is essential that there is a partnership, that there is partnership and identification with the work rather than division and hostility between spouses. I can't think of anything worse than a man of God endeavouring to carry out his work if someone else, namely his partner, is pulling in another direction, constantly making difficult, nagging comments about the way things are. There's nothing that would be designed to pull a man down quicker than that. You've probably heard of some in history. One famous case being John Wesley. He exercised a fantastic ministry, but the truth of the matter is that his wife was not with him, and indeed, sometimes she walked down the street after him and shouted abuse at him in front of people. Rather an extreme sort of case, but it is a matter of husband and wife just being frank with each other, sitting down and talking things through, keeping short accounts of one another, recognising that it's not just a one-person ministry, but that they are joined hand in hand and heart in heart in doing this work. And if they're not pulling together, praying together, then they're certainly not going to succeed in that work. It's probably only in recent years, really, that an emphasis has been placed upon couples rather than individuals where ministry is concerned. I don't know why we were so blind in the past, but so often when people would join an organisation or join a mission or be called by a church and so on, all the focus was on the man. I believe that was quite wrong. I think that we should have been looking at the couple, because they are a couple. God has joined them together. And their lives are not two, but one. And it's essential for us to recognise that oneness and that teamwork, and not to ignore one of the partners of the marriage. Now, one man who knows well what he's talking about on this topic is Billy Graham, and he says these words: understand that there is no conflict of responsibility with God. The work of an evangelist and the demands of family life are not irreconcilable to him. Any problem lies within us. Often a godly concern for those without Christ and the urging of others for our ministry make it difficult for us to refuse invitations to preach. Prayerful examination of every request in the light of our responsibility to our families is important. We must not feel guilty when we give our wives and children the consideration they deserve. This has been one of my own problems. As I look back over my life, I see that I have made many mistakes. One of them was accepting too many non-relevant invitations to the detriment of time with my family. Interesting words, aren't they, from such a man as Billy Graham. Now, we're still under the heading, aren't we, being together. And I think these are some considerations about being together in the home. A. Live the life at home. Consistency is essential. our godliness must show and count at home. Double standards and the throwing aside of a public facade will be a powerful negative force in the home, often turning children against the gospel. The example of a Christ-centered life is a most powerful positive force. Now, I don't think it's simply because I thought of it first that I put that at the head of the list here that we have in front of us. I do believe it belongs there. It is essential for us to have our lives match our words, and there's nothing worse than having the kind of life that our kids pick up on and say, ah, you're the sort of person that goes out there and preaches one thing but you live another one at home. You know, you're the sort of man of God that's out there in the church and wherever you go and you're preaching and all the rest of it, and you're a leading light there, but when you come home the light goes out and here you are around the house, you're an old grump and so on. And you know, kids can pick up on that. And they certainly will pick up on the way a man treats his wife. And if they feel that there's something phony here, oh, what a negative force it is. Now, that's the way to turn our children away, because they're saying, look, we want authenticity, we want something that's genuine. And we need to be very, very careful about the way we live our lives at home. You know, what kind of person are we when we walk through the door? Do our kids look forward to us coming home? I remember reading of Evie Tornquist that when she walked into the room, it was as though a ray of sunshine had just come in through the window. You know, that's a testimony, isn't it, to the presence of someone who it's just good to be with. I wonder sometimes when we walk through the door if it's not more like a dark cloud that's ready to burst or something like that. We need to be careful that in being together, our lives do exhibit a consistency. Now, I know, of course, that in family life, our weaknesses are going to come out. And I'm not really talking about those. Our children are going to accept us for what we are, but it's the facade, it's the hypocrisy that they don't like. And if we recognise the fact in front of them that, yeah, sure, I made a mistake, then they appreciate that. I think we go up in their estimation rather than down when we don't attempt to be invincible in front of them. In fact, I think being the perfect parent and being invincible and never wrong in front of your children is, again, a big negative, because your children are constantly living with this standard, this challenge in front of them. Parents never wrong. We are always wrong. Did you ever, you know, get that vibe when you were growing up? I had that vibe constantly as I was growing up. Now, everything that we kids did had to be condemned virtually, but parents never wrong. I think it sends children down the tube. It doesn't really encourage and help them to rise above the strains and the temptations of life and the weaknesses that they've got within themselves. And then be aware of needs. Now, that, of course, is most basic, that if a man is going to spend time away from home, he needs to have an ear to the ground. And the only way we're ever going to discover how other people feel is to be a good listener. You know, every relationship depends upon good listening. Terribly easy for us who are preachers to do all the talking, isn't it? You hear it around meal time, don't you? Who's holding forth at the table again? Who's giving his favourite opinions and so on? You learn a whole lot about people by listening to them and giving them a go, giving them a chance to speak. You know, I was brought up under the rule, little boys should be seen and not heard, and the other rule was, when I want your opinion, I'll ask for it. I wasn't asked very often, actually. You may have had that experience, I don't know. But the rule should be that if you've got something to say, you're free to say it. That should be the rule. Now, that's turning the thing right around, isn't it? But we had our children grow up with that rule, that if you want to say something, that's fine, you go ahead and say it. Now, if what they said was something that deserved a strong reaction, well, you know, the consequence was their problem, wasn't it? But at least we wanted to make it clear that there's nothing taboo, You say what you want to say. You know, you're free. You're free to say what you want to say. But then, on the other hand, we ought to do our share of speaking as well, because I have heard of some people who, because of the busyness of their lives and the pressures and so on, they don't want to do anything except sit in a chair and just read a paper. And I've heard young folks who've grown up to adulthood say, "I never really knew my father. Oh, he's a good man, but we never really cracked it. We never got right through to him. We never got to the understanding of how that man ticked. He always just seemed to be that bit aloof from us. And the older we got, the more aloof he became from us. Always polite and nice and paid the bills and all the rest of it, but you couldn't get anything out of him. Never really knew him." And of course, coupled with that very often is the thought, we don't know whether our father really loved us. Probably he did, but he didn't ever say so. So we need to watch that side of it too, that some men can be too quiet and too withdrawn within themselves. But the lines of communication ought to be open always between all members of the family. And then we ought to take care not to squash discussion or debate or to dismiss opinions out of hand. Very easy, you know, when you've got teenagers to say, "Oh, don't give me that sort of nonsense. I don't talk that rubbish around here." As you know, you can just put the lid on them so very quickly. Well, of course, if you keep on telling them not to talk, well, they won't. Many of them. They'll go somewhere else if they get a hearing. And if we're rude to them, you know, and we cut them off midstream and butting on what they're saying and so on, well, they'll go and get more civilised company when they're old enough. So it's important, I believe, to be aware of needs by having listening ears. I think your growing kids talk most when it's time to switch the light off. Ever notice that? I mean, they start it when they're young, they get practice at it. Amazing, you know, how there's some sort of connection between switching off the bedroom light and a child developing an immediate thirst. I want a drink. But they also love you to sit on the side of the bed and talk, because, you know, stalling for time is great at that hour of night. But if they open up and they talk, and they're not just, you know, waffling, but they really are saying something, we should value those times. And I mentioned to you that my kids who are now no longer kids have been away a lot, and two of them are now a long way away. Nevertheless, we have found through the years that they always want to gravitate back home, and then they tend to gravitate to the bedroom. Goodness knows how many times I've wanted to switch the light off and go to sleep, and I've got kids draped all over the floor and the bed and everything like this wanting to talk. Not kids, but adults. And I think it's great, because they just want to be there, and they want to talk, and they know that they're free to talk, and they know that they're accepted. But then prepare for absences. Now, there are many matters which a thinking person will want to bear in mind at a time of being away approaches. Now, I have to admit to you that I never always understood these things or paid enough attention to them. In fact, both my wife and I confess to the fact that for the first 5, 6, 7, 8 years of our married life, we didn't understand a whole lot of things about the way we should relate to our children, about this business of timetable and of making sure that we're spending enough time with each other and so on. We learned by our mistakes, as most people do. We made plenty of them. I know when I was first married, I thought it was terribly important for me to be on the go all the time, out at meetings, here, there and everywhere. And when I got home, I was in the study. And when I was at the table sometimes, my mind was wandering all over the place, instead of being really involved with my wife and the kids. As I say, you learn fast. There was a time when we were sitting around and our second daughter said, "There are 4 in our family. 1, 2, 3, 4. Then she pointed to me. She said, "I was wondering why I was not the 5th. And she pointed to me and she said, "You don't count because you're never here." Ooh. Oh, that hurt when you hear that. And then when our son arrived, I don't know, it just kind of hit me. I took a tumble. I thought, hey, this is my son. a real responsibility. I mean, I had a responsibility for my daughters too, of course I did. But for some reason, it was about the time the books began to come out about the family. You remember the first one I ever saw was Larry Christensen's book called The Christian Family. Well, that began the avalanche that we've got today of books on the family. They've poured out for the last 20 years. That's great because it's an immense amount of good and helpful information. We were beginning to learn these things and we began to understand how thoughtless we've been, particularly yours truly. I've been very thoughtless about numbers of things, like these. Look at the list of questions here that a man must ask before he goes away for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and sometimes, well, I've been away for as long as 2.5 months. I tell you, that's not easy. Number one, is there sufficient finance available for needs and emergencies? It's not good enough to leave somebody battling back there at home with, you know, just a few dollars, and you think to yourself, well, maybe she'll get through or whatever. We need to think ahead and recognise that there can be such things as emergencies. And here again, you plan that out the way you want to. I think it's great for your wife just to be able to look after it, go to the bank, get what she wants, and so on, so that she doesn't have that that worry about insufficient finance. And then, will the children know that good behaviour is required of them, or are they ready to make life more difficult for their mother? I am suggesting, and I make no apology for it, I'm suggesting that the man ought to make sure that they know. And I believe that's the way it ought to work. And then three, will the children who are old enough understand that they have work to do and will do it? Do they understand that? That's my complaint today, that too many fathers are weak and too compromising with their children. They don't spell anything out. They tend to almost get on their knees and plead with their children, will you do it? Will you be good? Will you stop doing what you're doing? And I've yet to meet a wimpish father who's ever brought up a family successfully. There may be some, but I've never met them. And I'm not at all convinced that it's God's way of doing things. And then, does my partner have links with friendly neighbours, friends at the local church or cell group who will share some concern for the family's welfare? That's a question a man should ask. I would even suggest that a wife should have two or three phone numbers at all times that she can ring if anything goes wrong. I'm just trying to cover the situation where, you know, father's in Rockhampton and here we are in Launceston, and there's a burglary or a car comes through the front fence into the lounge room or something like that. I mean, that's a bit drastic, but you know, there can be tremendous breakdowns, and I think that this is what happens when we go away. It's the way the evil one can attack us. I don't know how many times my wife has said to me, if the washing machine is going to break down, or if a kid's going to get sick, or if we're going to have an accident, it always seems to happen when you're away. Now, I could cite numbers of cases where that's happened. Numbers of cases. I remember that time I was away for 2.5 months. I was overseas. In fact, I went right around the world. And when I got home, I was checking up there at the airport, just so thrilled to see my family. And I said, where's Joy? She's the firstborn in our family. Where's Joy? Someone said very quietly, she's in hospital. Sure enough, all her arm mangled through broken glass, through a broken window. That's just one case. That's why your partner needs to have friendly contact and somebody who can do something should an emergency arise. We all need help. Does my partner know my program and share some involvement in it? Again, if anybody's going to feel guilty around here, it'll be me. Many times that I've fallen down on
the detail, and I've said to my wife, haven't you overheard my telephone conversations? Why don't you know what I'm doing? No, we should be sharing more closely than that. Will I remember to send cards, make calls, and generally try to keep abreast? Well, I think those things should be pretty obvious. And then D, a man must take responsibility for the well-being of his wife and family. Again, I'm strong on this, and I will argue for this case very strongly, because I don't believe that the chauvinist is the man who takes leadership in his home. A chauvinist is a man who fails to take leadership in his home. He's the guy who opts out, who's self-centred, and who couldn't care less about the welfare of the people who are around him. A man who goes his own way and does his own thing. But I say that the man who takes responsibility is a man who won't come back home and say, you did this and you failed to do that, and making all sorts of accusations. I believe he's the one who says, look, the responsibility rests on my shoulders, and I'm prepared to accept the buck. All right, that's being together. That's the long one. These other ones are shorter, and then we're going to have some time of discussion and questions. Working together. While families are together in a physical way, under one roof or even in one room, they may follow nothing else but individual pursuits. It's possible to remain apart even while being together. I touched on that just at the beginning. So, what's the answer to that kind of apartness even while we're physically in the one place? A plan project to do together. As children grow, it's good for them to know that work is to be enjoyed rather than hated. It's a terribly important thing that we may have forgotten. We hear about the Protestant work ethic and so on, and some people say it with a sneer today. I don't use those words, but I certainly don't sneer at work. Because I think if children are brought up with the thought that work's a bad word, you know, it's an evil, something you've got to get out of the road so that you can get to your pleasure, well, I think we're not teaching a good value there. In fact, I think there are just far, far too many young people in our community today who've been brought up in that sort of atmosphere, and they think that work is just one of those evil, horrible things you've got to do in order to get the money that's required to go and really live your life. And we like that in Australia. We say that Monday to Friday is that horrible time that you've got to put up with so that you can have the weekend. We've got a big emphasis on pleasure here in our country, but we should be able to show that work is something that we can enjoy. And when you're working together as a family, it teaches you a number of things. Cooperative efforts within the family have a binding power. They really do, when you work together and you cooperate together. New levels of conversation open up. We've discovered that. The kids will speak in a new way when they're working together. Maybe in the garden or whatever it might be that you've decided to do together. Such virtues as loyalty, teamwork, and mutual consideration are enhanced. We ought to go for all the virtues and values that we can find today, folks, because the more we plant these things in their hearts, then the better off they're going to be. B. The book of Proverbs speaks about skills for living and denounces laziness. Families will benefit by taking notice of these precepts. Working together is on-the-job training for the business of living. Now, you could go into the history of this, couldn't you? But I think you can just sort of mentally glance back into the past and realise that so very often in very close families, they lived and worked together on the property, didn't they? I mean, so many in rural life, and they do it in various parts of the world today. And there's an expectation that we all pull together. We've got our own chores, we've got our own tasks to do. And when we've done our work in the field, we can come home together and we can sit down together and enjoy each other's company. And only that kind of thing, being so lost in our suburban life, is rather a pity for us all. Now, playing together. I know this one is a more obvious one. Hasn't been said the family that plays together stays together, but it could be said. The family group is further bound together by recreation and fun. We should strive to do things as a family during the earlier years, as the opportunities will decrease as the family gets older. I'm saying there that when the kids are in their mid-teens and so on, they tend to have their own friends and their own pursuits, especially around about time for annual holidays or Easter or whatever. You get a bit of a groan then when you suggest that we all go, well, no, not again. If you haven't come to that point in your life, it'll come. But don't worry about it, because it's fine. You're raising your children so that they'll be independent and that they'll have their own lives to live. So when they begin to do it, don't be disappointed. That's what it's all about. You're raising them to be independent people. But here are some things we can do. A, plan enjoyable holidays. Play games as you travel and do some adventurous things together. And I look back with great joy to the times that we had together as a family growing. We took all the opportunity we could to go away camping. We used to go up into the Flinders Ranges in South Australia, and some of those times are just so precious in my mind. We still occasionally go, but not all of us together, because we're just so spread apart. But I imagine in the next holidays I'll be going up there with my son again to do some bushwalking, and some of the times we've spent there just walking together and going out on an overnight walk and sleeping in the two-man tent and so on, they're very, very precious times. Very precious times. And then B, institute some family traditions. Traditions usually surround certain days like birthdays and Christmas. You know, you begin to do something and then you repeat it because you like doing it, and then the kids expect it to happen. Now, these are good things. Enjoyable patterns of celebration will develop over the years to which everyone looks forward. James Dobson says, "The great value of traditions is that they give a family a sense of identity and belonging. All of us desperately need to feel that we're not just a part of a busy cluster of people living together in a house, but we're a living, breathing family that is conscious of our uniqueness, our character, and our heritage. That feeling is the only antidote for the loneliness and isolation that characterises so many homes today." And then take days off. Now that sounds like a bit of heresy, doesn't it? 1 in 7 on average is necessary as a minimum. My goodness me, I wonder if we were to really go into this here at this conference and ask how many people regularly have 1 day out of 7 off, really off. Oh, I wonder what the percentage would be. I have a feeling there'd be a lot of folks who'd, turn their eyes away and say, well, no, occasionally. Maybe some people who very proudly would say, never. I'm really unimpressed, to be quite honest, about people who never take time off. Unimpressed. Because I think, well, you know, if you want to see the long distance, you want to think about the long haul, you want to think about, you know, serving the Lord for a good time, giving your life to Him, then perhaps you better take some days off. And I mean off. Where you're doing something quite different. This, of course, will reflect upon your family, because, you know, if you're going to have a day when you're utterly free, at last somebody's going to have a chance to talk to you for a while, or say, make a suggestion to you, or say, Dad, can we go here? Or Mum and Dad, can we have a picnic? Or whatever it is. Well, then our final heading is praying together. And under this heading, I'm referring to the whole matter of living in relationship with God. The home is the greatest school of all, parents the most influential teachers of all. Worship together as a family. The old-fashioned institution of family worship holds great value. If not carried out daily, then as often as possible. It is profitable for families to learn and pray together. Other teaching will be given incidentally in the ordinary course of home life. Now, it sounds like I'm wanting to turn the clock back or something. Well, not exactly. I know you can't turn the clock back. But if it sounds as though I'm wanting to reach back into the past somehow and drag forward some of the things that people used to do, well, I don't apologise. Because I believe we've lost some valuable things. I just heard Dudley Ford say in that last session that very few Christians, no it wasn't, it was in John Bond's session, he said very few Christians touch their Bible between Sundays. Well, you know, that's no credit to us. It's not as though we can say, oh well, we've got past reading the Bible, we're very modern people now. So if daily Bible reading and daily quiet time is an old-fashioned idea, well, so be it. Let it be made a new-fashioned idea. Let's do it. And that's what I say about family worship. It's great for us to sit around the table. I suggest, of course, with family worship that we don't have some great, long, boring thing that's going to turn the kids off for life. But I'm suggesting that it's bright and that it is brief and that it is fitted and suited to the age group of our children, and that as they grow, so the thing grows and develops in a way that's going to attract them rather than repel them. But let's go for it. And then the parents being seen and heard. Now, children will learn fast if their parents show their trust and dependence on God through audible prayer. I think it's great when both mum and dad can open their mouths and pray in front of their children. The great ideal is that children will want what they perceive their parents have. I think this is what God intended, that children should look at their parents and say, when I grow up, I want to be like that. We must model what we teach. Well, we're nearly through the paper, folks. Hold to the gravity of Christian doctrine. There have been many unfortunate cases of children simply not taking the faith seriously after being brought up in its shadow. Children of ministers, missionaries and other workers, some of them, have somehow perceived that all the talk about God that they have heard doesn't matter all that much. Their parents have been concerned that their offspring have plenty of freedom and they'll not be branded as preacher's kids or Bible basher. Now, you may not think that that's the most urgent sort of note to sound in relation to the children of ministers, missionaries and Christian workers, and evangelists and so on. But in my moving around, and I do move right around Australia in my ministry, the number of times I have heard about this is quite alarming to me. Where parents have decided to be indulgent toward their children to the point that they say, oh look, I don't want to be too heavy with this. I think it's great for the children to pick things up for themselves and we'll just trust and pray that they'll come to know the Lord Jesus. And here they are in their teens and then in their 20s, then married and still don't know the Lord Jesus. And I think that this is really what's been happening in many lives. They don't really think that their parents have felt it to be urgent and serious enough. Somehow or another it's brushed off onto them that, oh, you know, it's a bit of a breeze being a Christian. We don't want you to think it's pretty hard. And as I say, they're concerned about these things like preacher's kid or things that others are going to lay on them when they go to school or whatever. They're so concerned about that. They want their child to be one of these real free people. Agree with freedom, I really do. But I also agree with this thought that if the Lord Jesus means so much to me and to my dear wife, that I can't abide the thought in my mind, I can't accommodate the thought in my mind that our offspring are going to go their way and not care less about the Lord Jesus. That'd be too hard. Now, as I say, there are many who are in that situation. I feel deeply for them and I'm not sure that there are any quick answers to it all. I think I've lived too long to think that there's some slick formula for raising children and seeing them go on in the faith. I've seen all sorts of mysterious things happen. I've never known why. I've just known that God's on the throne, and I know too that he's given to us power to choose, and many people go their own way. I know those sorts of things. And I also know that we should treat the things of God in all contexts with the utmost reverence and soberness. Otherwise, like Lot's sons-in-law, will they not think that we are joking? You remember how Lot's sons-in-law just didn't believe him when the urgent day arrived? Now, some of you, I can anticipate, are thinking to yourself, yeah, but what about the opposite mistake? Well, it's there, and I think it is prevalent too, so we'd better say something about it. And that of force-feeding children in an atmosphere heavy with prohibition, laced with law and practically humourless. Well, this is a different kind of home, because they've got a different kind of parents. Because these are the parents who feel that what they've got to do is to lay the law on their children and to sit them down and say, open big, and say, you know, open their mouth, and then they say, righto, here it is, we're going to shove it down inside you.
If this approach includes strict separation from this present world, an even greater rebel may arise than the one who has been spiritually starved. Now, it worries me when I see children being raised like battery hens or begonias in a conservatory. You know what I mean, don't you? Right from day one, virtually, there they are, cosseted and coddled. And as they grow, you know, they're sent off to their Christian school and never see a movie, film, and when they come home, you know, they go straight to your homework and their life is all schoolwork, meetings, scripture memorization, and don't do this and don't do that and don't do something else. It worries me about that sort of thing because, you know, I've been in homes where I've got these model children that sit around the table and they wouldn't say boo to anybody because they're all so scared, you know. Dad's there and he's one of these thumpers on the table. Well, yeah, it's a problem. I want to suggest that you don't have the free and easy thing over here on the other side where the gospel doesn't seem to matter. And on the other hand, you don't have your kids so much under your thumb that the poor things can't move this way or that, because as I've suggested there, they may turn out to be a bigger rebel than even the person who hasn't had any upbringing in the things of the Lord. Well, what's the bottom line? Well, I think it has been for me and for my wife, we would both say without any hesitation that the key thing to do, the primary thing to do, is to pray for them. It says here, pray for them privately from beginning to ending. Cover them and their life situation in prayer and give them back to God. We prayed for our kids before they were conceived. And we prayed, Lord, please don't give us any children that won't love you. And when they came, we prayed for them. Sometimes we prayed that they'd sleep in the middle of the night instead of keeping us awake. And then, of course, we prayed about all the various vicissitudes and emergencies and problems through their schooling years and getting them through matric and getting them through university and all the other things that they've done. And do we still pray for them? More than ever. More than ever. I've said here, pray for them from beginning to end. I don't know what the end is. But I dare say, while we've got breath in our bodies, we'll pray for them. Well, what do you say, folks? How many of us here are family people? I mean, in the sense that you're married. Some of you just getting prepared for it. Okay, hands down. Others might be praying for the partner or praying for the right moment to ask the question or be asked or something like that. Well, we trust that some of these things will be on file back there at the moment that you need them. It'll be stowed away in your memory. How many of us here then have children? All right. Very good. Okay. What are your thoughts then? Comments from you. Pearls of wisdom. Yes.
Middle of it all.
Yes.
When they come home from school, they thought, what have they got to do? It's got to be tomorrow, it should have been Friday. No, they're still doing it. And you're talking about how the time is very important to everybody. And you find that when they come home from school, the time that everybody else is going to work, they all want to talk to you because they feel that that time should be visiting them, that the time all these other things should be happening. Now, maybe you could spend a couple of minutes. I don't think that the answer is basically individual, but maybe you could share with us some of the ways that you've got around these things.
Yes. Yes, on the front page here we have the thought that, I'll read it again. Who would dare suggest that he has all the answers to the pressing questions that are raised by those desiring to maintain a happy marriage and raise a godly family in our times? And that phrase, in our times, is inclusive of all of this pressure that's talking about, which in no way would I want to minimise because I feel it's getting greater and greater. But then, I've used the next sentence, one can only suggest some guidelines, which is probably I can think of doing is some guidelines. The sort of guidelines that I would suggest to people are these. I would not look back at the end of a month and say, what have I done or what haven't I done? I think the thing to do is to look forward to a month with your diary in your hand. I remember hearing a man years ago talking about this subject. He was a psychologist in America, and he said, and a fellow rang me the other night and he said, what are you doing next Tuesday? You know, they have Tuesday over in America. We have Tuesday here. And he said, nothing. Oh, well, you can come and lead our Bible study. We've got one over at our place on Tuesday next week. He said, you didn't hear me. He said, I'm doing nothing. Now, this man was not only a psychologist, but he was also a businessman who owned a chain of restaurants right across the states. So he's a terribly, involved sort of individual. But he said, I take my diary and I plan ahead. And he said, I put nothing. He said, there are some nights when I sit with my wife and together we look at the fire and we look at each other and we just talk the whole evening. Now, I know there are logistic problems when you've got kids that are up to here. You kind of have to share yourself around a bit with them. I found with my kids that one would be playing softball or netball while the other one was playing cricket or football or whatever it might be. And I'd have to do a bit of a swap between the two, or say go 1 week with that one and another week with that one, or my wife go to one, I go to the other. We would tend to do a bit of that swapping around. But we were keeping tabs on things that were important to them. You know, I think it's important if your kids play sport on a Saturday morning to be there, not religiously, but at least to be there a fair bit of the time so that they recognise mum and dad are interested in this. When it comes to open nights at school, I would say to the deacons, look, well, I can't have it that night. Sorry, we can't have a deacon's meeting that night. It's an open night at the school. And as a parent, I would feel that was a pretty important thing to do. I think it would be terribly easy as Christian workers to say, oh, my wife can go along. But, you know, as your kids are in high school and so on, there are things that need to be sorted out with teachers and whatever. And I don't think it's a good thing just to send your wife off to do it. I think it's great for you to go together and sit with the teacher and say, how's our kid going? It seems to me to be a matter of priorities, but while I speak, please don't get the inference that I'm saying it's easy. It is not easy. It is just plain hard. And I think it gets harder. It's like an obstacle course. You know, you've got all things, obstacles in front of you, and you're flat out trying to work out ways of getting over them. But one of the things that I think is wrong about our Christian life, and it's been brought up a couple of times, is too many things on nights of the week. Too many meetings, too many functions as such. I remember going into the home of a Uniting Church minister who's a friend of mine in South Australia, and I said to his wife, you don't see much of naming him these days. He seems always to be out. She said, in the last 18 months, he's had two nights home. Two nights home in 18 months. Now, I want to say that is unnecessary. I don't care who he is. Guarantee Gordon Moyes would get more nights home than that because he plans it, he disciplines himself, and he just refuses to be caught up in trivial meetings. You know, we have our session meetings and our this great list of committees and stuff. If only that Monday, I'm saying this Monday to Friday ought to be the sort of time where course, you're saying, ah, look, you're not a pastor.
No.
Yeah. But I can see it's difficult, especially too if folks ring you up and they say, oh, you know, I must talk to you. And you had planned to have the night home. And here's somebody saying, it's urgent. Please come and talk to me. I mean, you could easily get in your car, go away and not come home till midnight, couldn't you? That sort of thing you'd want to be very careful about doing. I remember reading Gordon MacDonald. Has somebody read Gordon MacDonald's Ordering Your Private World?
That's an excellent book on the
subject. Yes, good book. Yeah, he said somebody rang him and I've forgotten what it was, Saturday afternoon or something, and said, oh, it's urgent, you know, our marriage is going to break up. And he said, well, how long have you known about the problem? Oh, well, for quite a long while. You know, what's the point of the crisis at the moment? And so on. He talked like this to her. He said, well, look, you know, I'm in the middle of getting ready for tomorrow, Sunday. He said, I think you'll need to wait till Monday. I'll come and see you then, or it might have been Tuesday. She said, well, all right, okay. She hung up. Now, he could easily have been caught up in her enthusiasm, or it wasn't enthusiasm at that point, but in her sense of urgency, he could have been caught up in that and had his whole program wrecked. But he refused to allow somebody else's chaos to ruin his peace. And that's an important thing.
I remember reading that. He said to the yeah, he said, if I come now, he's talking about Sunday's sermon, if I come on Monday, it'll be a Monday night of attention. Would it not be better to wait until Monday? I suppose a lot of these crises, we say to people, third marriage crisis, I can't see the president of the Lord's office a lot. Why don't you write down a list of all the things, et cetera, et cetera, they want? So he's right, if I start to do it, that 3 years or something, another 2 or 3 days or something.
No. Another couple of practical points is this, that I refused to let the school or anybody else, sporting teams or whatever, organise the life of my children. Now, they try to do it, especially today when they bring in Sunday training, Sunday practices, Sunday matches. Do you have that sort of thing in your circle? You know, if they're any good at sport, next thing they want them 7 days a week, virtually. Well, we drew the line at that. And you know, my son's right into volleyball, and is you know, at a very high level he plays it. But we refuse to get into this business of Sunday by Sunday going off to training and going off to this and that and the other. But they weren't deprived. That's my point. They weren't deprived. The other thing I was thinking of there. No, it's just slipped my mind, but I suppose the principle is this, that if other people want to say, oh yes, I know what it was, school excursions, if they say, oh, you know, you must go away for the weekend with the school, or the kid's got to bring $50 to the school because they're going away to a camp for 3 days and they must be in it. I'd weigh it up. I'd weigh it up. You know, sometimes we're given the impression that it would be educationally disadvantageous for our child to miss that thing. So they must say, and we as conscientious parents will do anything to get them along. Well, there were times when I weighed some of those things up and I said, no, you're going to stay back. Now, was I depriving? No, I don't think I was, because they had plenty of interaction with their peers. They had tons of it. We had the kids in our home week after week. Kids from the neighbourhood would come in. We had a club running and all that sort of thing. But I thought I was the one who was going to take them around and show them the world of nature instead of some other teacher, you know, telling them all about how all this evolved and all the rest of it. And I reckon as far as showing our kids the world of nature was concerned, we did it as parents. We took them. Now, I know the school has got to do this because there are tremendous numbers of parents who wouldn't ever bother. They would never do it. But I'm saying draw the line sometimes when other people want to organise you. Learn to say no.
The other thing too is working with secondary school students, as I do periodically. Yeah. I see photographs of what goes on school excursions, I hear reports and things like that, and that's sort of involved, I think, once you feel that way.
Fair enough. Some of it is not all that educational at all. I mean, it's education in the wrong sense, perhaps.
But the Christian type of government, kids crusade against things like that,
oh no. No, I think that they've got to have all that kind of thing. But I suppose I'm trying to unload them a bit. That's really it at the moment. You know, you can see a kid's life so organised, so packed with things.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and mum and dad are running the taxi around, you know. Take them here, take them here. Take them somewhere else. The car engine never cools down. But it's hazardous. It really is hazardous.
Just been planning for the future because I'm not married yet. I want to describe what men as we get egoistic in our ministry and we want to do it all ourselves.
Oh, true.
So then a lot of the times we know we must not come for our family, and the only way that can happen is if we have an expanded ministry team. But we don't want to do that. We feel we don't want to bring in more members to the pastor or whatever so that other people can take up the roles.
Yeah.
So I'm looking on evaluating my life and my problems and ego and all the rest of it and realise that other people have to be involved so that you can make time for the family. If God is the one who naturally is not going to get married, if God tells you to get married. If you are going to get married, you're supposed to have children. God will, if God says you're going to have children, then he must mean you're going to spend time with it. So you must really get other responsibilities out there.
That's right. In ministry, as Billy Graham was saying, that the work of an evangelist and the demands of family life are not irreconcilable to him. And I think that's a point that we can rest in. One frustration that I have, in even delivering a paper like this is that it's one thing for the evangelist and the pastor and so on who is present here to hear these sorts of things, but I would love the congregation to hear them. Because they're the ones that put the pressure on.
I was just wanting to say, I suppose I'm identifying and I'm hearing all these things and I'm saying yes. One of the difficulties, three children, five, seven, and a baby, we find is praying together. And you're mentioning about the old fashioned institution. We've had no models because the 60s, when we were growing up, there was no models. So it's very hard to sort of, it's a struggle all the time for this. Well, that's my experience. And we use scripture materials, hope and effort, with our kids. That's great for teaching them. The prayer idol is a big key, playing together. Being together, time out, all those sort of things. We're sort of working on all those, but this is the real area, the key area. You've got that, you're talking together and you're talking about your whole relationships.
No, I think what you're saying is good. Yeah, it is good. It's pretty hard to do it 7 days a week.
There's always something. Early on.
Because I think that's where you start. Sometimes it means, life is full of these sorts of choices, but sometimes it means making a very decisive choice to do it rather than to do something else. I mean, how easy it is when you're all engrossed in some TV program or something or other, and it's the moment that you perhaps should be switching it off or whatever. Or maybe it's at the end of a meal time, and this is when you usually have your prayer and Bible reading, but somebody says, oh, it's late, I've got to go, and then somebody else says, oh, I want to get these dishes out of the way. And, the easy option is to say, oh, I'll let it go for the night. But I think there's got to be a decisive approach that says, hey, listen, we're going to switch that off, we're going to sit down, and we're going to do it. I mean, life is full of choices like that, isn't it? I find in my own ministry that there are times, there's a football game, forget it, there's heaps of football games, switch the thing off and go do something that is far more valuable. And the easy choices, they get us, don't they, sometimes?
Sort of exhausted emotion, difficulty, sort of stand, keep with the sea going, and the muddy bug bunny and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, well, just some sort of entertainment, and then it goes on, and you're sitting around, don't wake up.
That's right. get caught with the next session then.
Yes.
Yeah. That's how it goes. Yeah. Churches educated on the question of what is their expectation of their staff, their pastors, their full-time people, because that I think is a really crucial area.
Kids growing up, you know, the education they get from Christian schools, Sunday school, whatever it is, kids club, it's just that much.
That's right.
The amount of input, the amount of experience input is enormous.
Yes. So much greater.
They've got 10, 15 years.
Yes, we've got to work at it. But getting to the back to the pastor situation, I'm very interested in what Roland Crouch is doing these days in his ministry called John Mark Ministries. He's inquiring into the reason why so many pastors have left the ministry, and he's found, of course, that there are as many ex-pastors in Australia as there are pastors, which is quite a startling thing, really. For every pastor who's out there active, there's a pastor in the world who's inactive. And there are reasons for it, and he's working on those reasons. I must get with him sometime, because I would really love to talk to him about this issue. Because I see over and over again an expectation up here for pastors, and they've really got to be such brilliant supermen, you know. They've got to be able to do everything and be everywhere, and if their kids are unruly, then they get criticised for that. But it's the demand on their time. The number of times the phone rings at the manse where people don't consider that they've perhaps just sat down for tea. The number of times they come knocking on the door of the manse. Sometimes, I've been sitting in manses and the place is just running with people. I mean, it's wonderful to have an open home, but people need a bit of privacy. And the minister and his wife need a bit of privacy. If only we could teach our congregations these things. Who are you a pastor? Any other pastors here? Yes, do you agree that so very often the manse is just invaded from within and without? Maybe not in every case, but I certainly have seen plenty of it. Yes. Expect you to be sort of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is so unfair. So unfair. Good. Well, thanks for your contributions, and we trust you'll enjoy the rest of the forum.